My name is Greg Taylor. I spent almost 17 years in prison for a first-degree murder I did not commit. I was exonerated in February of 2010.
Actual Innocence is a podcast that tells the story of people who served time for crimes they did not commit. Hear the heartbreaking, true accounts of those who have been wrongly convicted and then are proven innocent. Thanks for joining us.
What can happen in 6,149 days? Four leap years come and go. Four presidential terms are served. A child can become an adult, and an aging parent can become elderly. In the case of Greg Taylor, 6,149 days, almost 17 years, is the amount of time he spent incarcerated for a murder he did not commit.
I lived in Cary, North Carolina, which is a suburb of Raleigh. It's a kind of middle-class neighborhood I lived in. I was married to the girl who sat behind me in homeroom my senior year in high school. We had an 8-year-old daughter. My wife worked for IBM as a computer programmer, and I worked for a telecommunications company. Just typical middle class. We had two cats and a dog and two cars and a boat. So we would go out on the lake on the weekends or spend family vacations, camping, and things like that. Both my wife and I grew up in Raleigh, and we lived in Maryland for 4 years, and our daughter was just starting school, and we decided to move back to North Carolina where we could reestablish our roots and have the grandparents around, you know, for my daughter and stuff. So, yeah, we all had family in the Raleigh area. Long-time friends and things like that. So, you know, we owned our own home. We had good careers and we, you know, liked the area.
Greg was living the typical middle-class life with his wife, daughter, two dogs, a cat, and his extended family nearby. It sounds like Greg was a pretty fortunate individual until the night of September 26th, 1991.
That evening was fairly typical of my life at the time, to where I had the responsibilities of work and family, and then I would turn around and shirk those responsibilities and go hang out with my friends. And so that night was typical of that. And I was out partying and got a truck stuck in the mud, and the fellow I was with, both of us, after we got the truck stuck, and I took off walking, and we waved down a ride and got picked up. And the next morning, I went back to get the truck with my wife and my boss even. And police were looking at a body that they had discovered on the pavement in a cul-de-sac.
Her name was Jackie Thomas. She was 26 years old, and she worked as a prostitute. Her sister, Yolanda, described her as the adventurous one who thought of the things that got them into trouble.
My truck was stuck about 100 yards away off the road from the cul-de-sac. As far as, you know, what happened with Miss Thomas or how she came to be about in that cul-de-sac still remains a mystery. Because I do know that, you know, the reason why, you know, I was a suspect, of course, was because my vehicle was stuck, you know, 100 yards away. And the police see a body and the police see a vehicle, and they right away would naturally assume a connection. That's what happened in my case, is they assumed the connection, and then after that they kind of fell into a tunnel and only sought to confirm that connection and ignored everything that they found that disproved it.
Tunnel vision and other police and prosecutorial misconduct is the second leading cause for wrongful convictions, according to the Innocence Project website.
They discovered the body about 7:30 in the morning. I arrived maybe 8:30, and I approached the officer, one of the officers that was kind of barricading the cul-de-sac. And in my naivety, I didn't even think maybe they had seen my vehicle or knew that it was back there. So I approached this officer, and You know, and I told him, I said, I have a truck stuck in the woods back there. And I asked him how long it would be before I could get my vehicle. And the officer said he didn't know that I would have to talk to a detective. And so about that time, I kind of look away and there's this group of like four or five men that are walking across the circle, and they had on coats and ties, you know, like a stereotypical detective might have. And one of them stepped out of the pack and introduced himself as Detective Johnny Howard. I asked him the same thing I had asked the officer, how long it would be before I could get my vehicle. And he said, well, you know, we're conducting this investigation. We don't know how long it would be, and would I mind answering any questions? And I agreed to answer his questions and to help any way I could. And in my mind, it would be something along the lines of, what time did you get to the circle? What time did you leave? And what did you see while you were there? You know, maybe 15 minutes or something like that. And I agreed to meet him at the police station.
Greg was asked to come in for questioning due to the proximity of his truck to Ms. Thomas' body, and he agreed. Greg didn't consider calling an attorney because it didn't occur to him that he might be a suspect.
Probably got to the police station about 9 that morning. And within maybe 10 hours, my co-defendant and I were both arrested and put into jail with no bond for first-degree murder. So it started, it was in basically two parts, and it started, of course, when we arrived at the police station, and then I agreed to ride around with the detective and his partner and show him everywhere I had been that evening. And I took him to my house and let him go through my house and, you know, get the clothes I wore the night before and things like that. So, you know, it was a process throughout the day that I was being either interrogated or, you know, or showing them around town. Then after, my co-defendant had, arrived for questioning, which I never really knew, you know, I showed the officers where he lived and everything. And later that afternoon, there would be like these long periods where I would be alone in an interrogation room, and the officers would every now and again pop in and you know, interrogate me, accuse me, lie to me, threaten me, things like that. So that went on until probably, maybe 6:30 that evening, something like that, before we were arrested. I think the Center on Actual Innocence, who studied my case and represented me for a couple of years, went through my interrogations, and there were like 68 accusations. Maybe 107 times I declared I was innocent, and about 10 to a dozen times where they offered me opportunities to basically hand over my co-defendant and I could go home. The interrogation started out, I guess, benignly enough with just tell us where you were and who you were with from the time you got off work until the time you arrived in the circle. And so I went through all that with them, and as I was going through relating the events of the evening and who all I was with, they were particularly concerned with who was black and who was white. The guy that I got the truck stuck with was black. And when they had asked me his race and I said he was black, then the officer could not hide his this kind of surprise, like gleam in his eye, I guess. And it was at that point that the interrogation became a little bit more intense, and you know, he would start with things like, we have a witness that says something a little bit different, and telling what kind of evidence we're going to find, and maybe it'd be better for you to go ahead and tell the truth now than to pay the price for something somebody else might have done. You know, I was getting this, things like that said to me, and throughout that day, every time I had an opportunity to prove I was innocent, you know, I gave him the keys to my truck. I said, you'll never find anything from the victim in there. And, And I took him to my house, of course, and I gave him hairs from my head and saliva and the fingerprints, and just every time they offered, to show them that I was innocent, like, for example, well, give us the hairs from your head. That'll prove it one way or another. And, so I would. I jumped at all those opportunities. They asked me to take a polygraph, and I said, I'd be glad to take a polygraph. And then they wouldn't give me one. So the day was a lot like that. There was also, these accusations that when I felt so helpless, just pinned in a corner and they weren't listening, I would ask for an attorney, but then they would keep on. So it was four times. I requested an attorney throughout that day, and they never even stopped to give me the opportunity to call anyone. And, then there was, the lies that they would come up with. And a funny story, in my youth, I went to court for some kind of traffic thing and go kind of get paraded one in front of the other, one after another in front of the judge. And the guy that went in front of me, apparently, I don't know who he was, but apparently he had been, kind of, maybe offensive to the officer. The judge told that guy, son, there's only three things you say to an officer of the law. Yes, sir, no, sir, and I don't know, sir. And I was probably 19 years old when I heard that. And, 10 years later, I'm in this custody room and trying my best to show this guy, the respect that I felt he deserved. I mean, I believed in the system, and I did not think that an innocent person could be arrested. So, and I really felt like that whatever I was going through during this interrogation, would be straightened out by the end of the day. So when I was getting these lies, I thought that maybe he was being misinformed. I was trying to give him the benefit of the doubt and trying my best to convince this person that, that I had nothing to do with this crime and that the evidence would show that. And that if they would, if they would just look at everything, then that's what they would see. And that if he's being told that somebody saw us do something, that person is mistaken, and that will be proven in the long run. But apparently, it's okay for an officer to lie to somebody to try to get him to say something. So that's what that was all about. So some of the lies were, my co-defendant said that I committed the crime. He came in, the officer, came in the room one time, and he says, Greg, he says, we've given you every opportunity. He said, but Johnny, which is my co-defendant's name, he was the smart one here. He took us up on the opportunity, and he says that you committed that crime. And I said, well, I did not commit that crime. And he says, well, why does Johnny say you did it then? I said, I don't know. You have to ask him. I said, but I know I didn't have any part of it. And I know he didn't have any part of it. So that was some of the things. And he mentioned, blood in or on my truck or something. I said, there's nothing from the victim in that truck. He said, there's not. I said, no, none that I put there. So that was the kind of things I was facing. Over and over and over throughout the day, witnesses that say something different, or witnesses that say they saw us commit the crime and things like that. So of course, in the end, none of that was true, but it just took a long time to prove it.
Greg's interrogation sounds like typical use of the Reed technique. Basically, an interrogator uses an accusatory style interview delivered in a respectful manner in order to make the suspect feel like they are able to unburden themselves by admitting to the crime without judgment being passed.
And, I understand they have a job to do, and I understand completely that in my case, and maybe a lot of innocence cases, it starts out with dumb luck and a dumber defendant. And, and I lived a lifestyle and made a lot of mistakes in my life. And that's the reason why that truck ended up in the mud. But I had nothing to do with the victim, how she came about to be there. So I you know, on the one hand, I had the belief in the system, the respect for the law, and the understanding that, you know, that this was a very serious crime and that they needed to solve it. You know, but at the same time, I knew, you know, with everything that I know about me and the truth and the world and everything, that they're wasting their time by looking at me, right? At the time, it was more, I was probably a little bit more unaware, I guess, of police procedure and how things work, so that, you know, I really did think it would just be 10 or 15 minutes and, you know, then they would go about and actually solve the crime. And, you know, but looking back, I can, I guess, understand some degree of intensity there or whatever and their desire to get to the truth. But then in the end, I don't think they were really interested in the truth. I think they were just more interested in closing the case out.
A considerable amount of a police officer's performance review is based on their arrest and conviction rates, because those numbers are easily measured. This could lead a person to believe that securing an arrest is more beneficial to the officer than spending an extended amount of time on any particular case. I asked Greg to tell me more about the process of being arrested, as I, and many of you, have never had that experience.
You know, the only thing I had to go by was like what I had seen on TV or the movies and things like that. So I go into the jail and I'm asking for my one phone call, right? So I called my wife. They actually, they gave me, I don't know if they were like laughing underneath their breath when they're handing me the phone. But, yeah, I used my one phone call, so to speak, calling my wife, and of course she was floored, but she had to become an expert on attorneys, you know, in a matter of minutes or whatever. So after we hung up, she got on the phone and sought references and talked to, you know, whoever she could talk to that evening. And the next morning, when I had what they call your first appearance, when you're brought in front of the judge, I guess, and read the charges or however that goes, I was met by an attorney there. The attorney that I met, his name was Jim Blackburn, and I was familiar with that name and his reputation because in the mid-80s, I had seen this TV movie, Fatal Vision. And at that time, Jim Blackburn was a federal prosecutor, and he was responsible for convicting Dr. Jeffrey McDonald of supposedly slaying his family in Fort Bragg back in like 1970. In this movie, Jim Blackburn was portrayed, you know, as really a masterful arguer of physical evidence. And, you know, and I just remember him like wrapping some coat or something around his arm and, you know, and having somebody stab at it and showing that the stab wounds in the coat or whatever couldn't be like they were portrayed in the evidence or something. But anyway, I felt like I needed somebody on my side like that, that could get these physical evidence reports and see that I was telling the truth and then argue to the police or the prosecutor or whoever to, you know, drop these charges and go about finding out who actually committed this crime so I could get my life back. When I submitted the blood, saliva, and hair, and all this other stuff for the police to test, I was under the impression that it would only take, you know, a couple of days or so to get these reports back. And so, you know, what I was looking in an attorney was just somebody who that, you know, wouldn't be lost in the shuffle of paperwork or whatever, and that things could move along. You know, the way that they should, or the way that I thought they should. So, it just never occurred to me that, you know, it would take months for these reports to come back. And then, you know, it never occurred to me this whole thing would take the direction that it did either. So I got out on bond about 3 months later in December. And, I think like almost all of the physical evidence reports had come back by then. And so I was able to get a bond and, I stayed out on bond until my trial in April of 93. Jim Blackburn never, fulfilled, you know, what I believe was the obligation that I understood, which was for him to to ask the prosecutor and the police or whatever and get these charges dropped or somehow or another, you know, move this thing into a trial or something, you know what I mean? Because again, it never occurred to me that an innocent person first could be arrested. It never occurred to me that an innocent person could be brought to trial. So, in August of 92, I called Jim Blackburn and, you know, I wanted to know why he hasn't done any of these things. And I asked him, I said, do I need to be on your doorstep at 8 o'clock every morning to find out what's going on with my case? And he said, if I wasn't happy with it, that I could get another attorney. So I said, well, give me my money back. He said, I can't do that. I said, okay, well, then I'm stuck with you.
There is an obvious bias against public defenders and an implication that they are not as able to provide quality services to their clients as a paid attorney would. However, in this case, Jim Blackburn, a well-known and formerly well-respected attorney, did not appear to be living up to his obligations.
So now fast forward to January of 93, and my family and I get called into his office, and he's not there. And I look on the wall, and I see his name's no longer on the wall, and these, you know, brass plaques where they have all the members of that particular branch of the firm. And you know, and I said to myself, I might have said to my wife sitting next to me, I said, he's done something. And it really didn't surprise me, but come to find out, he did do something. And what happened was he was a civil attorney mostly, and he would take the occasional criminal case, you know, such as mine. But for the most part, he was a civil attorney. So he would have these clients, like, for example, if you maybe had a deck built and you weren't happy with the contractor, and, you know, so you needed to seek some kind of civil remedy, then you might hire Jim Blackburn. And months would go by, and you would never hear anything about your case. And so you'd give him a call, and he'd say, oh, I filed the paperwork, and I'll get back with you. And he never gets back with you. So you call him again. He says, I'm negotiating a settlement. And so you never hear back from him. You call him again, and he'll say, oh, I've got your settlement right here. So you meet with him. He gives you a settlement check, and come to find out, he's never done anything on your case. He's lied the whole way through. He's forged judges' signatures on court documents and paid you a settlement out of his law firm's trust fund. So that's what he got caught doing, and eventually went to prison himself for like a dozen felonies.
Jim Blackburn pleaded guilty in the early 1990s to forgery, embezzlement, and fraud charges stemming from crimes he committed while working at a private law firm. He lost his law license, served about 3 months in prison, and ironically, he's now a motivational speaker.
So, but that left me in January 93 without an attorney, and oddly enough, I actually did have a court date pending. So I had to rush out and find another attorney. At least I felt like I had to rush out, and I did find another attorney. You know, it's kind of weird. I always felt, you know, up until Blackburn, his actions came to light, I was a little bit concerned that I might have made him mad when I called him back in August, right? So, you know, I kind of felt like with this attorney, this new attorney, that maybe I would try not to make him mad and listen to him a little bit more, because, I mean, these guys are the ones with the experience and the education, and, you know, and all I knew was fiber optic networks. This attorney, after I had hired him, I would call him, you know, like I called him one day, and then I called him a couple of days later or whatever. And he says, Greg, he says, you know, there's no reason for you to call me. He says, I'll call you when I need you. And I said, okay, fine. So I might have talked to him one or two more times over the phone before he called me and said he was ready. And I met with him at his office, and he says, Greg, he says, I've been through everything. And by that, I guess he meant everything that had been supplied through discovery to the, to Jim Blackburn, because this attorney did not, file your, typical motion for discovery, which, every attorney, you know, in the world pretty much does. For some reason or other, he just relied on the other motion to supply everything. But in any case, he called me into his office and he says, I've been through everything. He says, and it's just like you said, there's nothing there. He said, a judge ought to throw it out, but if not, I don't see a jury in the world of convicting you. He said, I know you want to prove you're innocent, but that's not our job. That it's the prosecution's job to prove your guilt, and they can't do it. So he goes on to explain to me that tactically the best thing that he can do is not present any defense, no kind of evidence whatsoever, and that way he would get the last closing argument. And he believed that the last closing argument was the most important thing to him, assuming this would go to a jury, you know, that would be all it would take to sew up, you know, an acquittal. So there's the part of me that is relying on his experience and education, saying that's what the thing to do is. And then there's the part of me that's innocent, that, you know, believes wholeheartedly that the judge is going to throw this out, but if not, surely there's no way the jury is going to convict me. So what he's saying kind of, you know, resonates as true. But then there's that other part of me that is a sports fan. And, you know, I've never heard of the best defense being no defense. So there's this little voice in the back of my head saying, maybe we should, you know, just go ahead and prove I'm innocent, even if it's not our job. You know, we have the truth on our side. And of course, in hindsight, I think that, when an attorney has the truth on his side, then he should feel some sort of at least moral obligation to get that truth out and not try to rely on, you know, some sort of legal, hocus pocus or whatever to prevail.
Greg was getting ready to be tried for the most heinous crime a person could commit, and his original attorney, for over a year, was in prison for fraud. He was able to secure a new attorney in time for the trial, but his second attorney was basing the case on a no defense defense, meaning that no facts would be presented on the part of the defendant. His new attorney believed that the prosecution would not be able to prove his case and the jury would not convict based on that.
Yeah, I'm a Carolina basketball fan, UNC basketball fan, and on Monday, April 5th, 1993, UNC won the national championship. And my birthday is April 11th. And then on Monday, April 12th, my trial started. So my trial consisted of the prosecution presenting its case in its entirety and my attorney filing a motion to dismiss, which was denied, and then the closing arguments.
It appears that the no defense approach did not work in this case because the motion to dismiss was denied. It would seem the best defense is, in fact, a good defense. Greg's conviction was based on four factors submitted by the prosecution.
There were four salient pieces of evidence that the prosecutor presented, and two of those were jailhouse witnesses. The first jailhouse witness was in my cell block, and when my co-defendant and I were arrested, you know, we were put into different cell blocks. In the cell block I was in, this guy read the newspaper, watched the news, and, you know, listened to jailhouse gossip or whatever, and concocted this story and takes it to the police and says, you know, that I told him of our involvement in this crime. And this guy has 12-year history of crimes of deceit, you know, obtaining property under false pretenses, forgery and embezzlement, and, you know, even up to armed robbery. So he doesn't, you know, he'll point a gun to somebody's head and demand their money. So how much of a stretch is it for him to get up on a stand and lie for freedom, right? He's a proven liar. I mean, he's been convicted of it. but that's who the prosecution decided to put on the stand, you know, and disregard the facts of the case. You know, they never found the murder weapon. They know that we were picked up right there at the cul-de-sac. We waved down a ride. Somebody picked us up. We didn't even know. They actually found this woman. So, I mean, that was like the one piece of, detective work I felt like they did. And then of course there was no, hair transfer, fiber transfer, fingerprints, blood in the truck, you know, anything. So, and it was a bloody crime. Common sense even. I mean, yes, there's a truck stuck in the mud, and yes, there's a body on the pavement there. But at the same time, you know, when you look at it further, does it really make sense to commit this crime, get this truck stuck, and then just leave the body right there on the pavement for the world to find? When surrounding this cul-de-sac was nothing but woods and weeds and gullies and plenty of places to hide a body, so to speak. And then, of course, if it took a spoon and a fork or whatever to dig that truck out of the mud, somehow it would have got out. But instead, when we got the truck stuck, we're like, you know, I was like, well, I'm just taking this as a sign that I don't need to be driving for tonight. And we just set out walking.
Jailhouse informants are witnesses who testify about statements made by another prisoner while they are both incarcerated. In return for their testimony, informants typically gain leverage in plea negotiations for their own trials.
So the other jailhouse witness, and this is the way the police handled the investigation. Remember, we were arrested right at the very beginning after, you know, within 10 hours after they had discovered the body. They canvassed these neighborhoods with four pictures. Me, my co-defendant, the victim, and my truck. And basically going around saying, did you see this woman with these two guys in this vehicle? You know, put in the story that they wanted back out there. And they never got anything. Fast forward, you know, 16, 17 months, and there was a particular woman that they interviewed who told the police, yeah, I saw these two guys in this truck, but I don't even know the woman in that picture. They called her Jackie, the victim. And this girl says, I know a Jackie, but this doesn't look anything like her. In fact, the Jackie that I know, I saw the other day. Meaning that the Jackie she knew, she saw alive after the murder, right? But fast forward to the time of my trial, and she's in jail looking at 2 5-year consecutive sentences, and the prosecution agrees to run her sentences concurrent if she testifies against me. And then she gets up on the stand and tells a completely different story of how my co-defendant and myself and the victim were in her house doing drugs, and she saw the victim get in the truck as we were leaving, in the back seat of a truck that was a two-door truck. She somehow or another invented another door, and nobody seemed to mind. Not to mention the whole back of that truck was filled with boating and skiing equipment. You know how they have these tracking dogs where, like, if you escape from prison, the dog might smell your sock or something and take off down a trail, and then next thing you know, you're sitting by a tree, and the dog walks up and starts being affectionate. So the dog's done its job, right?
Canine units are commonly used in police investigations. Each dog is trained as a specialist in a certain area of law enforcement, such as trailing dogs that are used to find particular scents, cadaver dogs that are used to find bodies, drug dogs, bomb-sniffing dogs, and many others. The use of a canine unit can be beneficial to an investigation. It's only appropriate to use a dog that is trained for the specific purpose being investigated.
There was a dog. In my case, they tried to use the same sort of a dog to link the victim's scent to my vehicle. Picture the victim laying in a cul-de-sac, and they take the dog up the little trail from the curb a little ways towards my vehicle, and they key the dog to a victim's sin item. So you would think if the dog was really doing what it was supposed to do, the dog turned around and go back to the victim. But the dog was either being led or following a trail, because the dog knows what a trail is, away from the victims. For some reason or another, you know, that dog did not go back to the victim. Instead, the dog went up the trail toward my truck, but ignored my truck, walked right by my truck, didn't care anything about it, and then went into a gully on the other side of the truck, and they had to bring the dog out of the gully. And then they put the dog 10 feet away from my truck and say, here, try again, and give the dog the scent item again. And this time the dog goes up to the driver's door and jumps on it, and goes around to the passenger's door and jumps on it, and then goes and sits down next to the handler, which when a dog loses the scent is trained to sit next to the handler. But the handler wrote in his report that the dog's actions led him to believe that the victim had been in on or around the vehicle, or the scent from the victim had been in on or around the vehicle. And that's the whole thing about it. And the handler did testify that the dog was not trained to do what the dog did. But the thing about it was the handler wasn't trained either. So handlers and dogs are trained together because they have to establish some sort of communication. And this dog and this handler had none. I mean, the handler's trying to interpret the dog's actions when the dog hasn't been trained to communicate those actions. That was objected to by my attorney, and, you know, because I had read the dog handler's report, and I was like, well, what about the dog? And he says, don't worry about the dog. And by that, he meant, well, the dog wasn't trained, so we'll just object to it, and the judge will throw the dog out, you know, plain and simple. But it didn't happen like that. It was objected to, and the judge thought it was just fine that the handler could get up there and say what he thought about the dog. The fourth bit of evidence that the prosecution presented was a spot of blood found on the fender of my truck. What this was all about was, and this is to be the one thing I'm going to fast forward on to, but basically when there's a crime scene, then people try to gather evidence from that crime scene, right? And so when it comes to blood, they use two chemicals. They use luminol, which when you spray it on blood at night, it will glow. They use phenylphthalein, which when you put the phenylphthalein in contact to a substance which they believe is blood, then it will react a certain way. Phenylphthalein will also react to certain vegetable material and rust, and things like that too.
Phenylphthalein is a chemical that turns a pink color when it comes in contact with a particular molecule found in blood. It's not specific to human blood. Phenylphthalein also has a similar reaction to other various substances that contain molecules similar to hemoglobin.
They use the phenylphthalein to decide what to gather to take back to the lab and confirm. Okay, so there was a spot on my vehicle that reacted to the phenylphthalein, and we didn't even really know that much. All we knew is that the report that we got back from what was then known as the SBI lab, which thanks to my case is now known as the Crime Lab of North Carolina. So what we got back from the SBI Crime Lab was a report that said that spot gave chemical indications for the presence of blood. And the prosecutor took that report and argued to the jury over 17 times, how could I be telling the truth that the victim's blood was on my truck? Where else could that blood have come from? You know, and they do this whole elaborate presentation of how the victim was laying a certain way and the vehicle goes by and the victim's last dying movement, you know, and it just goes on and on. And so this spot of blood proves that, to, you know, the prosecutors say it proves that we could not be telling the truth. Very small spot on the fender, about half the size of a fly. And it was just, you know, from the pictures, it's a small red spot. And, And when I read the report, honestly, I thought that the victim was there before we arrived and we just didn't see her. And, you know, and I went for years kind of, you know, just about castigating myself because how could I have not seen her?
Stating that phenophthalein displayed chemical indications of the presence of blood means that the phenophthalein turned pink when it touched the substance. This does not mean that the substance was actually blood.
Yeah, the report said that the test gave chemical indications for the presence of blood. But the way it was argued to the jury is that that spot was the victim's blood. And that was the physical evidence they used to tie us to this crime. You know, there was no other physical evidence whatsoever. There was nothing from the victim inside that truck. There was nothing from us on the victim, nothing from the victim on us. You know, it just goes on and on and on about the lack of evidence. But the one piece or whatever that they used to tie us to that crime was that spot. Should I go ahead and tell you what the spot was? Well, this was in January of 2010. It's almost 17 years later when we were finally allowed to access the police prosecutor and lab files. When the SBI lab obtained that spot, they took it back to the lab and did confirmatory testing on it. They were basically so sure that it was going to be human blood. They didn't do DNA at the time. They were so sure it was going to be human blood that they went ahead and did both of their types of confirmatory testing on that spot. The first kind of test they do is called a Takayama test, and that determines if it was blood. And they also did an Octorlani test, which determines if it was human blood. And both of those tests came back negative. The lab had a policy back in 1991 that they were not obligated to report negative results. Should I say that again? The lab tested that spot for blood with two types of confirmatory testing that was negative, but they did not tell anybody. Instead, they provided a report that couched in the wording of that report meant that the spot reacted to the phenylphthalein. And they actually have the audacity to say in 2010, well, anybody can read that report and see that it was talking only about the phenylphthalein. The report said there was chemical indications for the presence of blood. It said nothing about the confirmatory testing. And so I asked my attorney, I was like, you know, how's the jury going to know the truth when they're not hearing it? He says, you know, the jury can infer so much, but there's no way they can close the gap, you know, in order to get this conviction.
I asked Greg if he could describe the jury, the very people who held his fate in their hands and hearts, the people who were tasked with deciding his legal guilt or innocence.
Fairly diverse, but I think what struck me the most about that jury selection process was how many school teachers, I don't remember how many there were in the end, but there were several being interviewed or whatever. School teachers are probably more likely to bond with a prosecutor. You know, you have your overworked, underpaid state worker, and he's sitting close to the jury box at a table all by himself with the sleeves rolled up, you know, and I think a school teacher could identify with that. Then you've got the defendant over across the room. They're you know, shooting darts at with their eyes and they don't hear anything from the defense. And so, you know, in the end, they're like, well, what do we have to go on other than what the prosecution said?
Greg's jury came back with a verdict in a matter of hours.
It was almost 2 hours, the best I remember. And I was, by that time, I had been so inured to anything that could happen in this case would be absolutely, you know, for the worst, that I was just stunned.
Join us next time for part two of Greg Taylor's story. I'm Brooke. Thanks for listening.
Thanks so much for listening to the Actual Innocence Podcast. Share your feedback and questions by emailing actualinnocencepod@gmail.com. We are also on Twitter at actualinpod. That's at actualinpod. Or search for our page on Facebook. Please show your support by rating us and giving us a good review on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for listening.
The rest of Greg's story on the next episode of Actual Innocence.
You know, the whole thing about that trial, I was out on bond. It was like show up in court and just sit there. You know, my job was to sit there, be unemotional, and in the end, the truth would prevail. So I wasn't, you know, looking for an escape or anything. I was just looking for this to be over and to go home. And, you know, in fact, the last day of the trial, you know, I kissed my daughter that morning and told her I'd see her that evening. And I didn't see her, you know, again until she was 26.